Good morning, Restore. You can be seated. Welcome. If you're just now joining us this morning, my name is Justin. I am one of the pastors here. I'm one of the pastors here, and we are at the very beginning of a new series on hope, particularly the Christian hope. And what we made the case last week is, and I want to contend similarly this morning, is that hope is an entirely underdeveloped muscle, if you will, for Christians. Right, so Paul lays down there are three sort of foundations of the Christian life, if you will, sort of three guiding principles, and he says these are these. It's faith, hope, and love. And so most of us have somewhat of an idea of what love is. I'm like, I think I kind of know what love is. It's this, you know, this thing where we give sacrificially of each other, that we are deep in affection for one another. And I kind of know what faith is. It's this idea that I trust, maybe I trust in what I can't always see. That's what faith is. But I want to contend that one of the reasons our hope muscle as Christians is somewhat underdeveloped, if you will, is because it's actually very difficult to define hope. Right? So if somebody were to ask you, like, are you a hopeful Christian? How would you answer that question? You're like most of us, we might kind of struggle to come up with an answer for that. Yet Paul says hope is one of the big three that guides the Christian life, that is the foundation, the guiding principle of a Christian. And I want to make the case this morning that the reason that hope is sort of an underdeveloped muscle for us, one, it's because it's very difficult to define for a lot of us. Karl Barth wrote this. Many Christians don't realize that they have hope or don't realize what the hope is because it's hard to really say that I have hope or that I feel hopeful. But I want to argue that one of the bigger reasons that hope is an underdeveloped muscle for us, one of the reasons that hope is hard for us to understand and grasp, and it's even harder for us to feel like we have sometimes, is because we're afraid of it. Hope in and of itself is a very powerful thing. In fact, if you look at the research on hope, and I'm borrowing mostly from the University of Oklahoma, they actually have a research lab that researches hope. But if you look at, and what they found is if you look at kind of like the 24 different, what you call like multi-variables that make up a person's personality, what they found was more than intelligence, more than character, more than anything else in a person, what determines a person's flourishing, what determines whether or not a person will flourish, is hope. But one of the scary things about hope is that it's devastating to the heart when we've lost it. All right, so Benjamin Franklin, one of our founding fathers, right, who's written a lot about, who was a deist, by the way, he was not a Christian, and whose ideas of God and philosophy around God has influenced our ideas of God in this nation in particular in more ways than we probably realize that it has. But he said that anyone who lives off hope, this is coming from Ben Franklin, this is direct quote, anybody that lives off hope will inevitably die of starvation. Even Socrates, the supposedly wisest philosopher who ever lived, right, the one that they make you study in high school in philosophy class, like the supposedly one of the wisest people that ever lived, called hope, what did he call hope? He said, hope is a foolish counselor. You see, the reason that our relationship with hope is so checkered, it's so complicated, is because I'm absolutely convinced nothing kills the soul more painfully, more excruciatingly, nothing withers our hearts more than loss of hope, hope gained and hope lost, right? Viktor Frankl wrote about this, and I'm recapping quickly here to catch us up to speed, but Viktor Frankl, the famous doctor who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, was a Holocaust survivor, spent 4 years in Auschwitz. He did four different concentration camps, most of it in Auschwitz, and at the end of his time, what he wrote was the thing that determined whether or not people made it, this is a doctor, by the way, someone who's very scientifically minded, was hope. And he gave an example in his book on hope. He said, I had a friend who had a dream. He had a dream that the Allies would liberate them on March 30th. I'm not sure where the dream came, but in his mind, they were going to be liberated on March 30th. And here's what he wrote in his book. He said, as the war progressed, it became obvious that we weren't going to be liberated. And on March 30th, my friend that morning got a fever. By that evening, he had lost consciousness. On March 31st, he was dead. And his conclusion was my friend had lost hope, and that had made him susceptible to infection. And this is actually consistent with what our research says. People who lose hope are more susceptible to illness than people who have hope. There's actually a substantial amount of research behind that. Nietzsche, that famous nihilist philosopher, right? One of those kind of champions of nihilist atheistic philosophy, said what? Hope is the evil of all evils. And what they're picking up on isn't that hope in and of itself is bad. What they're picking up on is the danger of having it and then losing it. What it does to the human soul. And so what we're doing this morning is we're going to look at Paul's version of hope. Paul gives us, there's two places in Romans where Paul talks about hope. One is Romans 5 and then one is Romans 8. He says essentially the same thing. We're going to be in Romans 8 for this series. But as you read this morning, Paul talks about hope. And he's going to give us a little bit of like, what is hope? So one of the things that hope is not, Paul's going to contend, and I want to contend, and actually the research support, is hope is not optimism. Hope is not this like sense of like it's all going to work out okay. Now, the research tells us that hope can breed optimism, right? Optimism can come forth out of hope, but the antithesis is actually not true. Research confirms, like, optimism does not breed hope. Right? Have you ever met somebody that's like overly optimistic, maybe even toxically optimistic? Right, there are times when an actual, accurate, like, appraisal of a situation is needed, and those are the times when optimism is not helpful anymore. That's what we call toxic positivity sometimes. And so what Paul's going to contend here is that the hope that we have, true Christian hope, the kind of hope that anchors our souls, the kind of hope that keeps us anchored in the midst of suffering, Paul's going to say, you watch carefully what Paul said. He says, it's something you can't see. You see, most of us measure hope based on what we can see. This is why Nietzsche says hope is so evil. This is as Viktor Frankl writes with my friend, like what hope for him was measured on what could be seen. But Paul's going to contend that hope, the kind of hope that anchors your soul, the kind of hope that keeps you anchored in the darkest seasons of your life, Paul's going to contend that you can't see it. And so the definition that I think Paul gives us is hope, of hope that I'm going to argue or contend with this morning is this. The Christian hope is something that you cannot see but cannot lose. It's a two-part definition. The Christian hope is something that you cannot see but also cannot lose. And this is good news. Because the good news is that the hope that you have is no longer contingent on your circumstances. It's no longer contingent on favorable outcomes. Instead, it's contingent on the work of God, who Paul will write all throughout his book in Romans. It's the hope that you have is based on God's faithfulness to you, not even your faithfulness to God. I want to make this point clear this morning. It's not even your faithfulness to God that anchors your hope. It's God's faithfulness to you, and you cannot thwart, change, corrupt, destroy, or push away God's faithfulness. And so what we're going to do this morning is we're going to spend some time in this idea that hope is something you cannot see, and that's the reason that you can trust it. Okay, so we're hardwired to trust what we can see. We want results. We want visibility. And yet, Paul's going to say, if we're going to trust this God who have infinite love and infinite wisdom to guide our lives, the hope that we have to have then, it can't be something that we can comprehend. It cannot be something that makes sense to us, because we make sense of things and we make things way too small. Okay, so What one of the things I want to point out here that Paul says is he says that the future glory that's coming cannot be compared to our present suffering. Okay, Paul says the future glory that is coming cannot be compared to our suffering. Okay, so this for us to inevitably talk about hope, to understand hope, have hope, to have it change our life, to anchor us in our darkest seasons, inevitably we have to try to understand suffering. We have to process suffering. Our suffering and our hope are linked together because it's because of suffering that hope is necessary. And so Paul will say that suffering, the suffering that we have, is not comparable to the hope that we have, to the glory that we are being brought into. Now, why this is important here is because a lot of times we see suffering as grit, as sort of this, like the reason that you stayed in school, right? What's the reason you tried to graduate high school even though you couldn't stand your math teacher or you had all these sleepless nights, right? I got to get through this because I got to get a job. Right, I gotta make some money. That's the reason, by the way, that most of you endure your employment, right? I gotta get through this. I gotta put up with my boss. I gotta put up with this workload because what? Because a paycheck comes on Friday. There's suffering here. Not that all of our work is suffering, but you know, like that's how we think about it. There's suffering that's happening here, but it's gonna make it worth it because of what happens here. And so inevitably what happens is we end up kind of seeing our suffering as sort of the equal but opposite of the reward. I got the paycheck and it was worth all of the expense reports I had to do this week. It was worth that meeting with my boss, right? The vacation I'm taking to Europe next year was worth this. But Paul doesn't use that kind of language. He says the suffering that we have now is not to be compared to the glory that is to come. And so what Paul's doing, what I think Paul's asking us to do here, and I'm going to quote Barth here for this, but I still think he has the best commentary on Romans available. He says, what Paul's asking us to do is see something that we cannot see, to try and understand something that we can't understand. The glory at which Paul is inviting us to hope in, Paul says, our suffering can't even form our conception of it. It can't even influence the way we think about it, right? When you sit with that paycheck on Friday, you're like, well, that sucked, but this was worth it. What Paul's saying is the glory of God, the glory that's coming for you, the hope that you have is not even, like, there's no reason to even, this, what happens over here isn't informing, influencing in any kind of way. In other words, you're never actually going to look at your suffering and go, well, that was worth it. Because there's something bigger happening. There's something actually more, I'm going to argue, there's something more beautiful happening here. Okay, so Christianity takes a lot of heat here, by the way, when we start talking about heaven. Even C.S. Lewis, that famous Christian writer that most of you probably read or are familiar with that influenced so much of Christian writings in the 20th century, what did he say? I'm always a little embarrassed when I talk about heaven. When I talk about this idea that all suffering is going to be wiped away and there's going to be this reality that God has created, like it always feels a little bit somewhere between naive and embarrassing. It doesn't feel like a true, and he's being a professor and somewhat condescending as professors are, but he's like, it doesn't feel like a true intellectually honest conversation. That's what Marx called this idea of heaven, like behind Marx calling religion the opiate of the people, the addiction that people need, was this idea, like he thought the idea of eternal bliss was naive. It's misinformed. There's a bunch of people who can't accept their suffering. They can't accept the limitations of this life. And so they've concocted in their minds this eternal bliss or this eternal reality. Right. Anthony Flew, that famous atheist philosopher from Oxford that kind of pushed atheism in the 20th century, was along with Bertrand Russell and a couple of those other philosophers, right? He pushed that. But one of the things that he said is the idea of heaven, what do you say? It's incredibly boring to me. No problems to work out, nothing but just bliss all day. He said the idea of just worshiping God in glory. He said this at the end of his life in one of his interviews. He's a world famous philosopher. This just sounds incredibly boring. And yet Paul's saying here that this hope of this coming eternal glory that Paul says isn't even to be compared to the suffering that we have. And I actually think what Paul's doing here is he's inviting us to consider the beauty of what's in front of us in a way that we maybe haven't before. So the field of interpersonal neurobiology is a fascinating field. It's, by the way, it's the field that informed the Inside Out movies, if you're a big fan of them. But interpersonal neurobiology looks at sort of the networks, the neurons, the insides of a person's brain that make them who they are. This is how the Inside Out writers got, you know, you go inside Riley's brain and you kind of see the different locations that the emotions of the characters go to. They're using interpersonal neurobiology field to kind of create this movie, which I think is really good, by the way. But one of the things that interneurobiology tells us is that when it comes to suffering, there are two parts of our neural networks that get particularly activated more than, there's nine realms, they call them nine realms of sort of the psyche of what makes a person who they are, but there's two in particular that get activated when it comes to suffering. One is narrative, and one is our perception of time, the temporal and narrative realms, they call them. In other words, our suffering informs the stories that we tell ourselves, both about our lives, about our worth, and about who we are. And the temporal part of our brains, our suffering influences, listen to this carefully, influences our perception of time. This is why boring classes are so boring. They're the same length as the class that you loved, but like because you're suffering through whatever your subject is, it feels what? So much longer. I mean, maybe my sermons, they're 45 minutes long. They're as long as most Netflix episodes, but maybe my sermons feel way longer, right? It's suffering influences your perception of time, including eternity. And so our suffering inevitably influences two areas, the stories we tell ourselves about our lives and our perception of time. So here's what one neurobiologist said. They said this, we construct what our future looks like. Listen to this, we construct what our future looks like. We can picture what our future looks like only so much as what we are experiencing in the present. We can only conceptualize our futures based on how our present is going. And what Paul argues here is our present is like groaning. It's like suffering. There is suffering. So when Paul says the future glory isn't to be compared to the present suffering, he's being a neurobiologist. He just didn't know it yet. What he's realizing is the current reality that we are in, if we're not careful, that informs how we think of heaven. And if we let it inform how we think of heaven, we're going to come up with a picture that's too small. He goes on to say this neurobiologist that I was reading, he says, current suffering is tied to our perception of time and our concept of the future, which makes it so hard to imagine eternity. Right? Our current suffering influences how we think about the future. So I remember in high school, I was 16, and I had a huge crush on Hillary, a girl at the time. And my friend Daniel, I'm going to throw him under the bus this morning. It's okay. I love Daniel. He sent us money during our rebuild. We're on good terms now. But my friend Daniel had an opportunity to go to mall with Hillary and her friend Christina. And what do you think Daniel did? Do you think he called me? No. No, he didn't call me. And I found out through Christina that Daniel was at the mall with Hillary. And I was like, Daniel's my best friend. Like, that's like, that should have been Wingman 101. And I remember, man, I locked myself in my room and listened to Nickelback and Linkin Park for hours, brooding over that lost opportunity with Hillary. Like, I was so mad. I was like, we were going to go to Hot Topic, and now you get to go. Like, you just kept both of them for yourself. Like, this is not how best friends treat each other. But I remember at 16... like, my social world was kind of collapsing, you know? I had a crush on her for a long time. She didn't know about it. Like, that was my opportunity, and I lost it. But you know why that opportunity was so devastating for me at 16? You know why I locked myself in my room and listened to both Linkin Park CDs for hours? Because I hadn't met Alyssa yet. You see, I had no idea. I had no idea what the beauty of marriage and love that was coming in front of me in my future. No concept of that at 16. Couldn't have thought of that at 16. I had no idea the intimacy that I would share with her, the strength of our relationship. By the way, like, Restore has survived because of the strength of our relationship and the intimacy and just like the companionship and the friendship that we've had. I have two beautiful children that I had no concept of when I was 16. Right, and I love Daniel and I love Hillary. If y'all are watching this or listening to this, I love y'all. Obviously not in the same way I did when I was 16. But the reason that that was so devastating, the reason that loss was so hard, the reason that it really unraveled me was because I had no concept, I had no understanding of the love that was in front of me just yet. No concept of the profound beauty of it. But also there's no concept of the strength of it. Right? When you're 16 and you fall in love, it's like, hey, we can go see movies together. And then as you grow through life and you realize it's not just movies that we go to do together, we start families together and we deal with stress together and we endure loss and death together and start churches together. Like, there's some kind of strength in that. There's beauty in that. There's depth. There's depth in that. There's depth in the beauty of it. That at 16, you just can't see. You just have no concept of what it's like to be committed to someone faithfully over a lifetime, or what it's like when they're committed to you. And this is, I think, why Paul says the present suffering that we have cannot be compared to the future glory. If we use suffering to provide any kind of context, any kind of understanding of what heaven is, what God is doing through and for our redemption, I think Paul says we're going to come up short. So the question inevitably becomes then, okay, so if you're saying there's some hope here, but I can't see it, and it influences my perception of myself, my story of myself, right? This is what suffering does. It influences the narratives we tell ourselves about our worth, our value, who we are as people. And it tells us a whole lot about how we experience our futures. If we're going to let go of some of that and grab hold of this hope that Paul is offering us here, then how do we kind of understand the present moment? Right? Because you're sort of like, right? And I've made like half a case here. Because I've said, look, well, there's hope, but you can't see it, but you just got to buy it. And that's not really where Paul's going to finish, but let's move on. Paul says, really, all creation is groaning, is the word he uses. We ourselves are waiting for this redemption, and we're groaning. There's some real disquietedness in our souls. There's something in us that is uneasy with the reality as we experience it. And what Paul is saying in a sort of paradoxical way, a way that we didn't anticipate, he's saying, this is a sign. This is a sign that you were created for something more. Okay, C.S. Lewis wrote something similar to this. He's like, if I can never find my place in the world, if I can never truly find a place at home in the world, then I have to be convinced I was created for another world. You see, what Paul's doing here when he talks about groaning, when he talks about creation, in this angst, this sort of middle ground of not quite right, what Paul's saying is this is a sign that your heart isn't dead yet. And Paul used this language in Ephesians particularly about being dead to our sins. What he's referring to is this idea that our souls are sort of just lost. They're numb. But while our souls feel pain, it's an indication to us that we are both alive. But I think a bigger truth is it's an indication that Jesus is alive. Because by him and through him and through him, all things exist, Paul says. And so Paul says, we've been created, we're being brought into, we're being invited into this glory. Okay, these present sufferings are not to be compared to this future glory. What is the glory that we're being invited into? Right, so if I were to ask you, what is the glory of God? Like, how would you define it? Most of us are like, well, he made the universe, which is true. He made the mountains, which is true. Like, we kind of tend to refer to the majestic things that God has done, which is not wrong. Those are true. This is generally how your Old Testament, by the way, and your Old Testament is sort of everything written before the time of Jesus. Your Old Testament is written this way. Like when we behold the glory or the majesty of God, it tends to be in his creation is how the writers tend to focus on God's glory. But when you get to your New Testament, something changes. Your New Testament writers very rarely refer to the glory of God in the mountains or the heavens, although it's certainly true. They're not. The New Testament writers are interested in pointing us toward the glory of God in a different way. Changes after the time of Jesus. The glory of God in your New Testament is in found in Jesus and the relationship that they have with one another. So John 17:22, Jesus says this, I have given him the glory. He's praying, by the way, to the Father. He's speaking to the Father. He says, I have given them the glory. That's us. He's given us the glory that God has given him, that they may be one. Listen to this, as we are one. The glory of God is found in his affection and love and embrace of the Son. The glory of God is found in this relationship of love. Over and over and over again, we read in Hebrews 2:10, in bringing many sons and daughters to glory, here it is again, the word, it was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through what he has suffered. Jesus. All right, so we made the case last week that God is both inviting us to hope and a hope that we cannot see, which then inevitably leads us to the question of, well, how do we trust it? Here's how we trust it. We trust it. While we can't see the glory that's being offered to us, we can see the suffering that God has endured for us. That is visible to us. This is why Paul says, I resolve to know nothing but Christ and him crucified. The glory of God, the writers of the New Testament start to contend, is found in this affectionate relationship that the Father has with the Son, as the Spirit binds, like the Spirit flows forth both of them from both of them in love. Love now becomes the glory of God. And when Jesus says, I'm inviting, I want them to have the glory that you and I have, it's this oneness, it's this affection. And so while we may not be able to fully anticipate what the glory of God in the future looks like for us because of our present suffering, Paul says, don't use the present suffering is not to be compared to the future glory. What we can start to begin to see and understand is that the glory of the affection that the Father has for the Son has for the Father, the way that the Son has laid his life down in obedience to the Father for each of us, this is the manifested glory of God. So in the book of Isaiah, we talk about the glory of God being high and lifted up, this throne that's high and lifted up. When you get to the Gospel of John in your New Testament, John says what? When he refers to the cross, Jesus is high and lifted up. The glory of God is in his self-emptying love that he pours out both to the Son pours to the Father, and both have lavished upon us. And so what do we do inevitably with this groaning then? If we understand that the glory that we're being invited into is this deep affection that God has for us that we may not be able to totally understand or grasp just yet, what do we do with all of the groaning? Here's what I want to contend this morning. We actually stay encouraged by it. Because it reassures our hearts that we're not home yet. You see, part of why we struggle with this, particularly in our culture, is our culture has really conditioned us to reduce suffering in every way possible. That's sort of the American dream, right? We want to reduce suffering in every way possible. But what Paul's saying is that's not possible, and the reason it's not possible is because you're not home yet. But there's an unchanging certainty that you will be one day. That the work of God through Jesus on the cross is bringing you home. That groaning, that uneasiness that you feel with the world around you isn't necessarily a sign that there's something wrong with you or that your faith is weak. It's actually a sign that God's redeeming you. And this is somewhat in, we've learned a very different version of this in Christianity, by the way, which has also been influenced by Ben Franklin and deism. And we tend to feel most secure in our relationship with God when things go well. When we feel close and we feel intimate with him and we feel there's deep affection for him, that's great. That's a good thing. And what Paul is saying is there's also some groaning. There's some angst that comes with this. And it's a sign that things are not where they should be yet. But you don't want them to be here just yet. We haven't arrived at the finished picture. You may not realize this, but Hans Sally, he was an endocrinologist, actually Canadian, but he was the guy in the 20th century that coined the term stress. Stress wasn't always, nowadays, we want to reduce our stress, we want to do everything we can to take out stress. I'm not saying you shouldn't do that, you should definitely do that, we do that as much as we can. But here's what he said, he's the doctor who sort of coined it and figured out what it was, and how it affects us hormonally and all of that, and he said, stress actually... People who don't have any stress kind of wither. So he actually went so far as he calls stress the salt of life. I don't know if I'd go that far. But his point is this. He says a human soul that doesn't feel tension with the reality around them isn't alive anymore. Things aren't the way that they should be. And stress awakens us to that fact. You know, it took me a long time to really learn this as a church planter because there's just so many parts of the journey. You're like, we made it, and then things get shaken up again. And you're just like, and so you're in this like, we made it, and then it didn't. And so like for the first, 2.5 years of my church planting experience, I was sort of waiting for the we made it phase. And it's exhausting emotionally. It's exhausting. It's not healthy. And I haven't been doing this very long. It's coming up on 3 years now. But one of the things is I've really prayed and kind of wrestled with these texts and everything. I genuinely try to wrestle with things that I preach on Sunday morning. One of the things I've found is if we spend our whole life waiting for the I made it moment, it's never going to come. And there's no freedom in that. There's just endless turmoil, endless angst over fear that our conditions aren't better, that they aren't what we wish they could be or want them to be. There's real discontentment in that. And Henry Nouwen said it this. He said, I used to be in ministry. I used to hate the distractions of ministry until I realized the distractions were the ministry. And I think it was something similar to what Paul's saying here in Romans when he says, the whole of creation's groaning. We're waiting for this. Those groans are part of the redemptive process. Do we want to reduce the groaning as much as possible, the suffering as much? Absolutely we do. Will you reduce entirely? No, never you will. And if you're waiting for that moment, those ideal circumstances, it'll never come. But that's also because you have to remember that you're waiting on a God to do what none of us can do. You're waiting on a God to deliver us from the thing that we couldn't deliver ourselves from. It forces us back into a state of dependence on his mercy and his goodness of us. This is why intentionally every single morning I pray, and when we gather as volunteers and we pray for the services, God, would you have mercy on us? This groaning that we have continuously reminds us that we are dependent on God's mercy, and the cross tells us we can trust that mercy, that it has our highest good in mind. Our supreme good in mind, so much so that God would pay any price in order to achieve and bring about that good for us. And so I'll close with this. Oftentimes I have conversations with folks who, I hear the same kind of essence, the same argument, same concern or fear in two different ways. But one is I'm not entirely convinced that God... I know there's stuff I want to pray about, but I'm not entirely sure he cares or cares that much. The other version of this is when I picture heaven, I know I'll belong, I know I'll get in, but it's still hard to feel like I'll be embraced in this eternal glory. And both underneath both of those fears or those apprehensions is the same, concern. And it's this idea that we are so used to forming a reality based on our current existence that the idea of imagining one where God hears and sees every need wipes away every tear, that we are embraced fully and celebrated as who we are, not isolated or alone, is so hard for us to conceptualize. You may not know this, but your brain, neuroscience tells us your brain scans for danger. Listen to this, your brain scans for danger 5 to 7 times a second. It means if you walked in this morning, as friendly as a church as we are, your brain is scanning for danger. And it's subconsciously, 5 to 7 times a second. Which means that when we try to conceive of heaven, when we try to conceive of a reality in which God redeems us and brings us into the embrace of his love, we're still doing it with brains that scan for danger constantly, which means our pictures of it are going to be so incomplete. Which is why Paul says, don't compare them to your current suffering. Instead, you have to jump out and try to see something that you can't see, believe in something that you have no concept of. Right? Every attempt that I think any of us make to try and conceptualize what the new heaven and new earth will look like will fall short because our brains are still looking for danger. Right? This is interpersonal neurobiology, the whole field. So your current experiences inevitably influence how you think of the future. And what Paul is trying to say is there's a future that's coming. Don't use your current circumstances to influence that. They cannot be compared to the suffering that you've endured now. One of my favorite quotes from Lord of the Rings, and I'll close with this, one of the characters in Lord of the Rings, and if you're not a nerd, that's okay. I'm also going to spoil it for you. I assume at this point, if you haven't seen it or read it, you're just not going to, so I don't feel guilty. But at the end of the book, Sam meets Gandalf, who he thought was dead, and he looks at Gandalf, and he says, Gandalf, I thought you were dead. He said, no, I'm not. And then Sam says, well, then again, I thought I was dead. And then Sam looks at Gandalf, and he says, does this mean that all things that are sad are going to come untrue? And Gandalf says, yes. You see, this is what heaven is. It's the ways in which we are grieved, the ways in which we are grown, they become untrue. They're inviting us into a reality that we can't quite conceive yet. If I'm hungry, I can picture eating. It's much harder for me to picture a reality where I'm never hungry again. If I'm lonely, I can picture having a friend. It's hard to picture a reality where loneliness never even impacts my perceptions of myself or my relationships. You see, what eternity and this hope of glory that's being offered to us, this is why hope, restore, when we say hope is our value, we say our deepest wounds are being turned into eternal glory. I'm gonna be honest with you, I don't really know what that means. I have no idea how to conceptualize it. And yet all I can tell you this is the deepest wounded parts of our hearts that we thought we would live with forever will become untrue someday in a way that we can't possibly even begin to conceptualize yet. And if we try to, we're going to sell it short. So don't compare our current suffering to our future glory. Instead, we wait patiently as we groan. We know that our hearts are still alive. We cling to that. Because as long as our hearts are still alive, we know that we have hope. Let me pray for us as we finish this morning. Father, I admit just how wholly inadequate my words are to explain something so profoundly beautiful. The hope of your glory, the hope of glory that you're inviting us into. So, Father, would you forgive me for my inadequacies, for the ways that I don't make sense? Would you speak through those words anyway, as imperfect as they are? Would you help us? Father, would you help us to trust you? Father, for all the ways in our lives that we can't picture eternity just yet because of where we are in the present moment, our present circumstances, would you ignite in our hearts a hope to trust what we can't see? If we can see it, then it's no real hope at all. If we can conceptualize it, it's no real hope. What we are hoping in is something we can't see yet. Would you let that help that anchor our hearts, God? Would you transform our hearts? Help us to trust that so that as we suffer, as we endure loss and pain and heartbreak, Father, would you help us to know that they are the future glory is incomparable to what we are experiencing now? Help us to trust you, Father. Would you have mercy on us? Would you help us to never forget our total and utter dependence on you? Bring about your redemptive plan for our lives, to weave again in our stories and who we are a tapestry that we can't see and won't see until the end. But we know we can trust because it isn't to be compared to the current sufferings that we endure. We love you, Father. Would you help us? We pray all of these things in your name. Amen.